From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Baseball's All-Star Game will be played next Tuesday night at the Camden Yards Stadium in Baltimore. Today on Fresh Air, we feature three former All-Stars, Hall of Famer and former Cincinnati Reds second baseman Joe Morgan, Hall of Famer and former Yankee slugger Mickey Mantle, and former Yankee pitcher Jim Boughton, whose book Ball 4 blasted the image of some of the game's heroes. This is the debut of a special weekly edition of Fresh Air, featuring some of our favorite interviews from the archives, the shows you've asked to hear again, plus some special surprises from way back in Fresh Air history. Also today, TV critic David Bianculli reviews the new HBO miniseries, Laurel Avenue. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, we have the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The United States and Japan have reportedly reached agreement on a trade pact designed to reduce the trade imbalance between the two countries. The Associated Press quoted administration sources as saying the agreement was reached after lengthy negotiations. The administration has scheduled a briefing for reporters later in the day. In earlier negotiations, the United States had demanded that Japan agree to specific numerical goals for increasing its imports. Japanese negotiators said that such specific goals would amount to managed trade. Details of today's reported agreement haven't been released. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers says federal levees south of St. Louis along the Mississippi River should be able to withstand floodwaters if the latest predictions are accurate. But smaller levees along both the Mississippi and Missouri rivers continue to break. NPR's Kathy Lohr reports.
Emergency management officials are evacuating 7,000 people who live along the floodplain in St. Charles County, Missouri. There was another large levee break last night, and water continues to pour over levees in several spots that just aren't high enough to keep the water back. St. Charles police are getting two helicopters to get to people who've been cut off by the water. Sergeant Rod McGrew is with the city's police department.
We have two large areas of the county north of St. Charles here that have been cut off from access due to the flooding. The Missouri River has broken through a levee and has basically joined the Mississippi River in certain areas, and we can't get through on a road.
Officials are also trying to get mobile home parks relocated to higher ground. The Mississippi River rose a foot here since yesterday, and the Missouri is rising even faster. I'm Kathy Lohr in St. Louis.
The Muslim sheikh, whose followers are suspects in a recent bomb plot in New York City, has been denied his appeal for political asylum. NPR's Maria Hinojosa has more.
The Board of Immigration Appeals in Washington rejected Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman's request for asylum and also refused to reverse a deportation order issued in March. Egypt has said they want to extradite the sheikh, who advocates the overthrow of the government in that country. The sheikh turned himself in 1 week ago to immigration authorities and is being held at a federal correctional facility in upstate New York. Although the sheikh was on a watchdog list of undesirables, he was granted a U.S. visa in 1990 and later was given a green card. The Justice Department says those were human errors. His lawyers say the sheikh was once tied to the CIA. The sheikh has not been charged with any criminal wrongdoing. His followers in Egypt, angered by the sheikh's detention, have threatened to take action against American targets in the Middle East and Europe. In New York, this is Maria Hinojosa.
Stock prices closed slightly higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 7 points to close at 3,521. This is NPR News. Three Israeli soldiers were killed today and two were wounded in an artillery attack in South Lebanon. Israeli security sources told reporters that the attack was staged by Hezbollah guerrillas in the part of Lebanon that Israel occupies as a self-declared security zone. Israeli helicopter gunships attacked guerrilla bases south of Beirut, killing one Palestinian guerrilla and wounding three others. German left-wing extremists have warned that they're resuming armed battle against the state in revenge for the shooting last month of a left-wing terrorist. Deirdre Berger reports from Frankfurt.
Germany's extremist Red Army faction says it no longer feels bound to its pledge last year to stop killing leading members of government and industry. The announcement was made in a letter mailed to the French news agency AFP. German criminal officials say the letter is authentic. The left-wing terrorist group says it is reevaluating its methods due to what it called the execution of member Wolfgang Grams by federal authorities nearly 2 weeks ago. Criminal justice officials in Germany are still trying to determine who shot Grams during a capture attempt. The badly planned action has already caused the resignations of Germany's interior minister and the federal prosecutor. Government authorities say they expect a new wave of attacks by the terrorist Red Army faction. Tomorrow, thousands of left-wing sympathizers are expected at a rally in Wiesbaden to protest the shooting of Wolfgang Grams. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berg in Frankfurt.
Health Secretary Donna Shalala has called for a high-level investigation of how thousands of hemophiliacs were infected with AIDS by contaminated blood products. People with a bleeding disorder and their families have charged that companies knowingly distributed tainted blood products between 1982 and 1984. That was before a test was developed to screen bloods for the AIDS virus. Officials estimate that more than half the nation's 20,000 hemophiliacs have the AIDS virus. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Baseball's All-Star Game will be played Tuesday night in Baltimore. Joe Morgan played in 9 All-Star Games for the National League. He tied a then-current record for hitting consecutively in 7 All-Star Games. Morgan is one of the few second basemen to make it into the Hall of Fame. He was inducted in 1990 after playing 22 years in the majors, mostly with the Houston Astros and the Cincinnati Reds. He was with the Reds in the 70s, along with Pete Rose, Johnny Bench, and Tony Perez, when the team was so successful it was known as the Big Red Machine. In 1975 and 76, Morgan was named Most Valuable Player, leading the Reds to the World Series championships both times. After Morgan retired from baseball, he went into business. He now owns a beer distributorship. He also does color casting for ESPN and Giants games. He recently published a memoir called Joe Morgan, A Life in Baseball. I spoke with him last April and asked him why there are so few second basemen in the Hall of Fame, fewer than any other position.
Second baseman's main job is to play defense and make the double play. Neither are very glamorous things in baseball because they look for people to hit home runs, drive in runs, do a lot of great things. And normally that doesn't come from your second baseman because they're usually small in frame and small in stature, quick feet. Quickness is their main asset, not power. And therefore, in the past, there have never been second basemen to drive in a lot of runs or to hit home runs. Roger Hornsby did those things as a second baseman, and he was elected to the Hall of Fame. But most of your second basemen in the past, Charlie Gehringer, Bobby Doerr, had a little power, and I added something to that. I hit more home runs, I guess, than any second baseman that's ever played that position. So that made me a candidate for the Hall of Fame. But the real reason is because their main jobs are defense, and they're not known for their offensive numbers.
What did you like and not like about playing that position?
You know, I can't think of anything I didn't like. I was very proud to have been a second baseman in that I think it takes a special type of person to play second base. The rules have changed a little bit now, but when I first came into the league and when I played, there were no rules governing how a guy could come in and knock you over. And I always felt it was a really kind of a test of your character and manhood to be able to stand there with your back to the runner, knowing that he's going to try to break you in half, and your first thoughts had to be make the double play first and then worry about my body. And very few people can do that and do it well. And that's why I was always proud to be a second baseman. And really, there were no negatives as far as I'm concerned for me as a second baseman. I just loved the position.
What were your worst moments of impact?
I had a few. One, 1969, I was stretched out to receive a throw, and Tommy Agee from the Mets hit me with a cross body block, which is a football block. As I said, there were no rules then, and tore up my knee like a football. I had a football injury. I had O'Donohue's triad, which is the worst you can have, worst knee injury you can have. It's collateral ligament, cartilage, and just a lot of damage to your knee. And they never figured I would be able to play second base again.
You were considered one of the most complete players in the game because you had a great hitting record, stolen bases, great at second base. I mean, a real all-around player. You got Most Valuable Player twice. Is that something that you consciously tried to develop, to be an all-around player?
Yes, it was. I did not go out to be the best, but I wanted to be the most complete player in the game. And I think I reached that goal in, 75, 76 in that era. Growing up in California, my father would take me to the minor league games, Oakland Oaks. We would see the players, and my father would say, well, he's a good player. He can hit, but he doesn't feel very well. He can feel, but he doesn't hit. And my father always impressed upon me to try to be a complete player. So I think I worked harder on my defense than I did any other part of the game. Everyone loves to hit, and usually that's where they channel their energies. With me, I channel my energies toward my weaknesses. If I was a good hitter, which I was all during my minor league career, but I was not as good defensively. So I worked very hard on my defense. Then I worked very hard on my stolen bases. I did everything to make myself a complete player. I set one year when my knee was torn up, I sat behind home plate every single game and charted things about how a pitcher delivers the ball to the plate, how a catcher sets up for a pitch out, how everything happens defensively to stop you from stealing a base. So that made me a much better base stealer because I knew everything that they could do by the time I got back on the field. And so that helped me to be a complete player. I used to work out every day from 3 o'clock till 5, making double plays, and then go play a game. I sacrificed some of my statistics that year because I was tired by the time the game started. But I had a goal in mind, and I reached that goal at the end of that season when I thought I was a complete player, and I was a good defensive player by that time. So I had to work hardest on my defense, and I was probably most proud of my defensive accomplishments.
Let's talk about your height. You're one of the comparatively shorter players from baseball, 5'7", I think. In your book, you write that your first game in the Astrodome, that you were worried about being a little guy in a cavernous stadium, but then you realized that you were a player of the future. You were ideally suited to these new parks. What made you feel ideally suited to them?
When I first started, and I remember they wanted all big guys because they wanted them to hit home runs. All right, with the Astrodome, there were like four other new stadiums being built at the same time. And in the new stadium, they were going to house football and baseball. So the stadiums were becoming larger. And what happens in large stadiums is that now all of a sudden, the home run hitter is not as productive as he was in a smaller stadium. So you have to look to other ways of scoring runs. And the other ways were speed, and obviously you need defense in a bigger ballpark. And you just need to have a sense of how to play the game. I think it's a smarter game in the larger ballparks than it was in the smaller ballparks. And the Astrodome was the first of the large ballparks. And it was also the first ballpark with AstroTurf. AstroTurf puts a premium on speed and quickness rather than power and home run hitters. So I knew that I could make myself a player of the future by learning to steal bases, by playing better defense, positioning myself better, knowing more about how to play bigger ballparks. And again, I did all of that, and I think that's the reason that I'm in the Hall of Fame, because of that year spent of really learning what the modern player was going to have to embody.
We're talking about baseball with Joe Morgan. Now, you grew up near the old Oakland Park.
Yes.
Did you go there? Were you in walking distance? Could you just walk over there?
Walked over. It was a great. I had a great childhood. My parents always made sure that I was able to enjoy the fruits of being a child. You know, I didn't have to mature too quickly. I was not expected to know everything at the age of 10 or 12. I could be a kid and enjoy life. I lived about, I'd say maybe 8 to 10 blocks, you know. Everything looks bigger when you're a little kid, you know. So it may have been a little less. But we walked to the stadium, to Oaks Ballpark. Oakland Oaks were the home team in the Pacific Coast League. And my father and my oldest sister, Linda, I'm the oldest, but she was next to me. We would walk up, we'd eat dinner every night at home, walk up to the stadium, watch the game, come back home. I mean, it was like, you know, as a kid, like I said, that's the greatest thing could happen to you, to be able to go to the ballpark with your father every day that the team is in town and to enjoy it and learn about the game and be able to watch future major leaguers and great players that you want to emulate as you grow older. And so I was able to go to the game every day, and it was really a great experience that I will always treasure.
So your father must have been a big baseball fan too.
Oh, yes. My father is, he still is, and my father was a big sports fan. We would go also to the San Francisco 49er games. My father would take me each Sunday.
Couldn't walk there.
No, couldn't walk there. But my father was a baseball player. He played, you know, but it was before the color line was broken, and my father, and I had like three or four uncles. Two of them they think were good enough to make it to the major leagues, but again, in those days, and they grew up in a small town, and it was Bonham, Texas, which is, you know, not where you're going to find all your major league scouts watching anyway. But even in those days, you know, minorities were not, blacks were not able to play in major leagues.
So did he play in the black leagues?
Yes, he did. He wanted, but not the major league black leagues. He played in what they did was, we were in Bonham, Texas. There's 20 little cities around there, and they had leagues, you know, Negro leagues, and they play it there. You know, they have schedules, and they would play. And I was kind of the bat boy at the beginning for my father's team.
Gee, so your father probably had not only a sense of baseball, but a sense of race in baseball.
Yes. Oh, yeah. My father, as I try to say in the book, I think the one thing, I'm not a typical person because I didn't grow up in a poverty situation. I didn't grow up in the ghetto, so to speak. My father, but it wasn't because we were rich. It was because my father worked very hard. My father worked two jobs, so to speak, a lot of his life so that I could have everything I wanted. I mean, when it was time for me to get a bicycle, I said, I want a bike. I'd go down and get a bike. When it was time for me, I want a race car or whatever, my father would take me to get it. And I always thought, hey, well, you know, we must have a lot of money, you know, because we were always able to do that. And my father, I had a dollar a day for school, and it was like it cost 25 cents for lunch, right? So, I mean, you know, I had all this money. And all the other kids thought my father was rich and whatever. And I didn't realize any differently as a kid. I didn't realize except I know my father would go up in the middle of the night and go to work again, you know. And you think in terms of, well, he's going to work. But I didn't realize, you know, as a kid that you're only supposed to work 8 hours a day, you know. But he was going to work all the time. But we always, when we needed something or wanted something, it was there, you know. And so I didn't grow up in a poverty situation. I didn't grow up where maybe my childhood would have had me distrusting other people or not liking certain people. I didn't have that environment as a kid.
My guest is Hall of Famer Joe Morgan. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Joe Morgan, one of the few second basemen to make it into the Hall of Fame. When you were scouted and you got into the minors, you were in the Carolina League first. You were playing in the segregated South. And you write about how you were so absorbed in baseball. It took you a while to actually realize what segregation meant, what it meant in your life then. So what were some of the things you were up against that bothered you most during those days in the minors?
Well, when I first started playing professional baseball, well, I grew up in California, you know, as the old cliche goes, some of my best friends were white, some of my best friends were blue, green, whatever. I mean, I just had friends, and I didn't think in those terms, and they didn't think that way either. So I went to Durham, and then we went on our first road trip, I guess about a week after I'd been there, maybe 10 days. And so we're going to Winston-Salem. And I drive, we're on a bus, we drive to Winston-Salem, we go to downtown hotel, and everyone starts to get off. So I start to get off. And the bus driver, who was black, says, hey, wait a minute, you don't get off here. I said, what do you mean? For my team. He said, no, we stay in a different section of town. And man, now that's like, you know, what do you mean? I'm part of this team. No, you're over there. So I sit back down, we go over to the black community, and we stayed there. Wasn't as the accommodations weren't as nice, didn't have any air conditioning, but the food was great, so I had a great time as far as that. And that night, you know, we're separate rooms. He said, let's go, it's time to go to the stadium. So we get in the bus. Now we go back to pick up all my teammates at the hotel downtown. We pick them up and we go to the stadium, and we all get dressed, and I walked out, and all of a sudden everything kind of became very clear, and it was like a slap in the face. It really woke me up. I see a sign that says colored drinking fountain. Then I see one that says white drinking fountain. I go a few steps further, it says white restrooms, and then it says black. I mean, it said colored in those days. And now that I thought that was bad, right? So then I walk around the fence to go into outside the playing field. And when I walked around to enter the field, the fans, there were a lot of fans in the right field stands, and they started yelling, you know, clapping. And I looked over, and there were a lot of black people there. And they were clapping because they didn't see, there weren't any black people on the Durham team in the past, you know, and here I was there. So they started clapping, and I looked over, and I got very upset because there was a screen there, and it looked like they were in a cage. You know, it was, and you know, again, this is my perception of what I saw. You know, maybe it didn't feel that way to them. Maybe it didn't look that way to other people, but it looked that way to me. It looked like they were in a cage, and that disturbed me quite a bit. And I felt like that I was helping this image to continue. By playing this game, I was as guilty as everyone else. I was part of this, thing that was really, to me, just downgrading to black people. And I said that I was going to leave. I said, I can't, you know, play and be a part of this. So I left, and I went and actually called and made reservations to go home. And then I played the game. My reservations were to leave the next morning. I was going to leave. I said, I have more respect for my people in this than to be a part of this and to be a part of continuing to degrade the situation. Just being a part, playing there to me was part of, I was a part of it. So I was going to leave. And after the game, I went back, packed my bags, and I was leaving the next morning. And the bus driver, of course, tried to talk me out of it. And I said, no, it's just something I have to do. And I guess, you know, as I say in the book, it was nothing like thinking about what Jackie Robinson had to go through or other minorities had to go through to help make the country great. The only thing that kept me there was having to face my father and tell him that I quit. And so I decided to stay. But I don't think I ever got over, and I don't think I ever will get over, the feeling I had the first day I walked around there and I saw all those people. It was very devastating for me.
Joe Morgan is my guest, Baseball Hall of Famer, author of a new autobiography. So what was it like in 1990 when you were inducted into the Hall of Fame?
You know, it's something that I've tried to describe in the book, but I don't think that I could ever do justice to it because I'm not a poet. I'm not someone who can, you know, have great things to say with their words and their feelings. I really, it was like this most special moment you can have, you know, as far as I'm concerned. As a baseball player, I'd won, you know, the Most Valuable Player Award. I've won world championships. And I thought nothing could top that. I thought, hey, this is like, I mean, the way I felt after our first world championship was like, I had this feeling that I was like in space or someplace. I'm like just floating around. There's nothing. There's no other pressures. There's no other problems in the world. And I felt perfect, you know, that for that first 20 minutes after we won the world championship. And when I went to the Hall of Fame for the induction, it started slowly because I had never been to the Hall of Fame before. I'd never been up there to the Cooperstown. I went a day early. I got a private tour of the Hall of Fame. And I guess it started to build up then. When you walk into a place and it's like a mausoleum, it's so quiet. It's like unbelievable. And you walk in and there are plaques with images of Babe Ruth and Hank Aaron, you know, Ty Cobb, all the greatest players who've ever lived. And then they show you the spot where yours is going. You know, they're going to have a picture of Joe Morgan there. And, you know, it just starts to build up to know that 100 years from now, you know, whoever walks into the Hall of Fame will know that Joe Morgan was here. They may not know who I was or care, but they will know that I was somebody special because I played baseball. And I have two daughters that are 2 years old. And one of these days they'll bring their kids there and be able to see that. So that was probably the most emotional day, as I am now, for me, you know, in my life. It really was. And to stand there, I guess, with all the greatest players in the world behind you who've ever lived, like Ted Williams, Willie Mays, Stan Musial, and to have to talk about Joe Morgan was very difficult because in my own mind, you know, I will never, I guess, be able to compare myself to Willie Mays or Stan Musial or Mickey Mantle, because to me, that's when I was a kid. Growing up, these people were like not real. They were superhuman people, and that's still a problem for me. It really is, and I think of myself as being you know, I say that they left big, big footprints and I only left a small one. But however small, when you go to the Hall of Fame, I'm sitting right next to them.
Joe Morgan, it's been a pleasure to have you here. Thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Joe Morgan has a recent memoir called Joe Morgan, A Life in Baseball. This weekend, HBO presents a three-hour miniseries called Laurel Avenue, starring a predominantly African-American cast. It examines a weekend in the life of a large, extended working-class family in St. Paul, Minnesota. David Bianculli has a review.
Watching Laurel Avenue without thinking about the state of African-Americans on TV is kind of like watching Woody Allen's newest film without thinking about his domestic disputes. It can't be done. But let's try for just a minute. Let's look at Laurel Avenue purely on the basis of plot and character. If you do that, what it really is becomes clear. Watching Laurel Avenue is like tuning into a soap opera that's already been running for a long time. You have to get to know the characters on the run, but that's not hard to do. You get involved in the relationships and storylines, but then, in this case, the show suddenly stops. There's no real beginning to Laurel Avenue and no real ending. Just 3 hours of drama, trauma, sex, violence, and personal conflict. It's like we're visiting these people for only a weekend. A lot happened before we showed up, and a lot more will happen after we leave. What I like most about Laurel Avenue is that it takes place all over the place. There are the mean streets and cramped apartments that always show up in urban dramas, but other scenes are set in high school gymnasiums, movie theaters, bookstores, even in church. Mary Alice stars as Maggie, a mother who's duly concerned about her daughter Sheila, played by Melinda Williams. In this scene, the daughter and mother meet after church with their local reverend, and small talk turns quickly to big issues. Michael T. Rambo plays the reverend.
Sheila?
Hey, Reverend.
You're looking very lovely, Sheila.
Thanks. You're looking kind of fine yourself.
Well, it's come to this, Reverend Potts. Sheila is carrying condoms around in her purse. Now, I have nothing against the use of condoms in the right circumstances. But Sheila's only 16. Now, she's a good student and all. I'll give her that.
You know that I'm a strong advocate of sex only after marriage. And when I counsel teenagers, I make it very clear. But we have to look at the reality of the times, Maggie. With teenage pregnancies and worse, all these diseases, AIDS and all.
But I don't think 16-year-olds can deal with, you know, all those emotions having to do with sex.
The director of Laurel Avenue is Carl Franklin, who made the critically acclaimed movie One False Move, and he does a fine job here with a very strong cast. He's also benefiting from some very good timing. His miniseries is coming along at a time when the family drama series on TV is all but dead. Just as, years ago, The Cosby Show came around when the sitcom was supposedly an extinct species. Cosby got credit then for restoring dignity to the family unit, but also got blame, which he didn't deserve, for not representing all African-American lifestyles. He wasn't trying to. He was basing it on his own lifestyle and did a fine job translating that into the sitcom form. No one show should be expected to represent all blacks, any more than Roseanne or Gomer Pyle should be expected to represent all whites. The real scandal when it comes to shows about African-Americans is that TV doesn't generate enough of them to provide a wider and fairer spectrum. This new HBO miniseries adds to the mix and could be, and should be, a weekly series. But even in this brief burst, it's good to have, and it's good, period.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. As a prelude to next week's All-Star Game, we continue our special edition of interviews from Fresh Air's archives with two All-Star interviews. First, a 1985 interview with the great Yankee slugger and Hall of Famer Mickey Mantle. Then a 1986 interview with one of his former teammates, pitcher Jim Boughton. Boughton went into journalism after baseball, and his 1970 book, Ball Four, was a look at the seedier side of our cherished national pastime. Ball Four tarnished the image of some of the game's heroes, including Mantle. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. There are reports that the United States and Japan have reached agreement on a new economic plan. In Tokyo, the Kyoto News Agency is reporting that the two countries have agreed on a new economic framework aimed at putting trade between the two nations into better balance. The Associated Press, quoting Clinton administration sources, says the two nations have agreed on a broad blueprint of principles designed to cover future trade talks. President Clinton had a breakfast meeting in Tokyo with Russian President Boris Yeltsin before Mr. Clinton heads for Korea. Earlier today, the Russian leader thanked the Group of Seven for a promised $3 billion in aid to help Moscow move to a free market economy. Yeltsin said that he was treated as an equal at the summit. Rain continues to fall in already drenched parts of the Middle West. The Mississippi River and its tributaries that feed it continue to threaten homes and businesses in Iowa. From member station WOI, Mark Moran reports.
In central Iowa, the town of Ames was deluged by more than 4 inches of rain overnight. In Denison, 7 inches shut off electricity and sewer service to the town. To add to the danger of record floodwaters, the weather turned violent across Iowa last night as tornadoes ripped through the sky. The last thing that Iowa needs right now is more rain, but that is in the forecast. Iowa Governor Terry Branstad has asked President Clinton to declare parts of the state a federal disaster area.
We have 4,000 families that have been evacuated. We have hundreds of roads that are closed, and we have National Guard on duty in many locations around the state.
The Mississippi River reached its highest level in history late yesterday, breaking a 28-year-old record. Rain is now in the forecast into next week. For National Public Radio, this is Mark Moran in Des Moines.
Bosnia's president says that the nation's collective leadership has turned down plans for a three-way division of the former Yugoslav Republic. NPR's Ann Gerrels reports from Zagreb.
Izetbegovic told a press conference that 7 of the 10 members agreed to reject dividing Bosnia along ethnic lines into Serb, Croat, and Muslim states. Izetbegovic raised speculation yesterday he would capitulate to Serb and Croat demands. He appeared to suggest Bosnia would be forced to accept the division because the option was an indefinite civil war, what he called an ugly option. But today he said the presidency has accepted the proposal Bosnia-Herzegovina be a federal state. In other words, he said, the ethnic division of Bosnia has been refused. 6 members of the presidency will travel to Zagreb tomorrow to meet with the other 3 for a final vote. Talks with international mediators are expected to follow. I'm Ann Gerrels in Zagreb.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 6 points in very heavy trading. This is NPR News. In Somalia, gunmen reportedly fired 2 mortars into the UN compound in the capital, and 4 people were injured, 2 of them seriously. The injured are said to be UN peacekeeping soldiers from Norway, part of a 19,000 UN force now in the nation. It's believed to be the first major attack on the compound in recent weeks. The site was evacuated after an ambush last month when 24 UN Pakistani troops were killed. An arrest warrant has been issued for clan leader General Adid in connection with the ambush. Reports from southern Lebanon say that 3 Israeli soldiers have been killed in a second day of clashes. The reports say the soldiers were killed in attacks by Shiite Hezbollah guerrillas inside the security zone declared by the Israelis. John Devitt reports for the BBC.
Israeli forces have been involved in a day of fierce fighting in southern Lebanon. It began with an Israeli helicopter attack on targets said to belong to Palestinian guerrillas of Ahmed Jibril's Popular Front close to Naama, south of Beirut. Three people were reported to have been injured. Ahmed Jibril's organization said it carried out Thursday's ambush on an Israeli patrol, killing two soldiers. Israeli leaders have declared their intention to seek revenge. Israel's chief of staff singled out the guerrilla group Hezbollah, which has been responsible for a significant upsurge in attacks against Israeli forces in the last few months. Hezbollah has reorganized its military structure, improved its training, tactics, and weaponry. As a result, there were more attacks against Israeli forces last month than in any other month for 3 years.
John Devitt reporting for the BBC. According to auto trade groups, automobile sales in Europe in the first half of the year were off by 17.5%. The French and European Automobile Manufacturers Associations report that sales in 17 Western nations last month were down more than 18% in June compared to the same time last year. The only market to show improved sales was Britain. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Baseball's All-Star Game is coming up next Tuesday. We've gone into our archives to bring out interviews with a couple of former All-Stars, Mickey Mantle and Jim Boughton. It's part of our new weekly edition of Fresh Air, featuring interviews from the past. Mickey Mantle played in All-Star Games 16 years. Mantle is one of the greatest hitters of all time. He was voted into the Hall of Fame in 1974. He played with the Yankees for his entire Major League career, which lasted from 1951 to 68. Mantle came to New York from a small town in Oklahoma. I spoke with him in 1985, after the publication of his memoir, The Mick. He told me it was hard to adjust to the big city and to make the transition from Class C ball to the majors.
First of all, I wasn't Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig and Joe DiMaggio all rolled into one like they said I was going to be, and the people started booing me, you know. In fact, I got sent back to the minor leagues my first year. I started striking out a lot. I'd lost all my confidence. Casey had to take me out of a game in Boston because I struck out five straight times in a doubleheader. He took me out of the last game, and when we got to Detroit on the next trip, he sent me back down to the minor leagues, and I went like one for 25. That's one hit and 25 times at bat in Kansas City, which is AAA. And I'd really lost my confidence by then, so then I called my dad down in the mines, and I said, Dad, I don't think I can play anymore baseball. I'm down at Kansas City. I can't even hit here. He said, where you at? And I said, the Aladdin Hotel. And he said, well, I'll be right there. And he drove all the way from Oklahoma up to Kansas City. And I thought he was coming up to be sympathetic with me, to pat me on the back and say, hang in there, kid, or something like that. When he came in the room, he just threw my suitcase on a bed and started throwing clothes in it. And I said, what's the matter? And he says, well, I thought I raised a man. He said, you're nothing but a coward. He said, you don't even have any guts. He said, I'm going to pack your things. You can come back to Oklahoma with me and work in the mines the rest of your life like I did. And I said, well, it took me about 30 minutes to talk him into giving me another chance, you know. And then afterwards, I started hitting again, and the rest of it's history.
Why do you think you fell into that hitting slump when you first joined the Yankees? Was it the difficulty of facing major league pitchers, which you weren't used to?
Probably. I never had hit major league pitchers before. They find out something. If one of them happens to throw a fastball high and inside where you can't hit it, and they find out you can't hit it, they have a little, they're like, they stick together, you know. Their word gets around fast. This pitch mantle, high fastballs on the inside of the part of the plate when he's hitting left-handed, and he can't touch it. So that it gets around. You got to learn to lay off of it.
When it became clear that you were going to be a great home run hitter, would you always go for the home run when you were up at bat?
Well, I went for the home run every time I swung at a ball. I was trying to hit it as far as I could. That wasn't just when I became a home runner. I was always a home run hitter from the time I was a kid. So that's all I like. I love to see how far I could hit a ball.
You started getting a lot of strikeouts when your home run record started to really rise. Were you swinging at anything in an attempt to actually get something that?
Anybody that hits a lot of home runs is going to strike out a lot, except Roger didn't strike out that much, neither did Joe DiMaggio or Ted Williams. But most guys like Schmidt, myself, Babe Ruth, I broke Babe Ruth's strikeout record. I struck out 1,710 times, and when I retired, I was the most. But Reggie Jackson now has gone past me, Willie Stargell. All the guys that strike out a lot are home run hitters. I mean, if you're going to hit the ball a long way, you have to swing hard. You can't be like Pete Rose and punch it to left and right and something like that. You know, you have to swing hard at it. And if you swing hard, you're going to strike out a lot.
When you thought you had a home run, would you stand there and
No.
Watch it, or would you just start running just in case?
The Reggie trot, I didn't do
yeah,
that.
Yeah, you
no.
didn't do that.
In fact, I never tipped my hat or did the high five or anything like that. It always embarrassed me, really, to see the opposing pitcher. I hated to look at the opposing pitcher because I knew how he must feel, because I knew how I felt when he struck me out. You know, he didn't jump up and down and wave his hands and tip his hat when he struck me out, so why should I do all that when I hit a home run off of him?
What did you think of your hero status in America? I mean, you were a symbol for, you know, just about every person, especially boys growing up in New York, and then across the whole nation. You were a symbol too. You were an American hero. You stood for baseball. You stood for, you know, what was good about the country. Was that a lot to live up to? Did it feel like you?
Well, yeah, you have to, you have to really watch yourself. I felt like I did anyway, and the Yankees always, you know, like I used to like to chew tobacco, and they made me quit chewing, or they asked me, they couldn't make you not do it, but they asked me don't chew tobacco because, you know, it don't look like a Yankee, and the kids now, they look up to you. If I was drinking, I would try to stay out of sight. You know, I never did smoke because I was afraid. I did do a Camel commercial one time, and I always wished I hadn't have because my dad didn't like for me to do commercials like that. I don't think he would have liked for me to do a beer commercial. I did one of those. I did a lot of things that I felt bad about later on, but at the time, it didn't seem that important.
Yeah, at that same time that you were the national hero, you were really doing a lot of drinking, too, and I think you were famous for your carousing among baseball players.
I'm more famous for it now than I was then. A lot of people are surprised when they read that book because they didn't know I even drank. And when you read the book, it sounds like I was an alcoholic, but that's the farthest thing from the truth. It's just that the fun that I did have through my baseball career was when I was drinking. I mean, I guess my personality came in a bottle, for as I know, because the stories that I tell in that book are probably 15 or 20 things that happened over 18 years. And if you read the book, it sounds like I was an alcoholic. And that's another. If there is a moral to that book, it would be for little league kids or kids in high school or college, anybody, in fact, to take better care of their bodies, because guys like Willie Mays, Hank Aaron, Stan Musial. All the guys that are really good and that are their names are at the top of the list in the lifetime statistics are guys that took good care of themselves and played 20 years. I was over the hill at 34 and had to retire at 36, and it's probably because I didn't take as good a care of myself as I should have.
In Jim Boughton's book, Ball Four.
I don't talk about Boughton's book.
You don't talk about it? Well, let me just say this, that he reported a lot of things about your drinking and also appetite for women and desire to like see women through looking through telescopes and stuff in hotel windows. Is that the kind of stuff that you think shouldn't be mentioned in print?
I've got some things in my book that probably shouldn't be mentioned, but they're in there, you know, and it's about me, though. It's not about somebody else.
Mickey Mantle, recorded in 1985. Coming up, an interview with Mantle's former teammate, Jim Boughton. This is Fresh Air. Baseball's All-Star Game will be played next Tuesday, and in keeping with our All-Star theme, I should note that my guest Jim Boughton played in one All-Star Game in 1963, in which he pitched one scoreless inning. Boughton's 1970 memoir, Ball Four, was considered scandalous at the time it was published. Boughton described players' behind-the-scenes antics, getting drunk, peeping through keyholes at women, and taking uppers before games, the kinds of things you didn't read about in sports magazines. Outraged baseball commissioner Bowie Kuhn said the book did a grave disservice to the sport. The book's champions thought it was about time sports writers stopped sanitizing the game for the public. These days, Jim Boughton runs his own product development company, does motivational speaking, and is working on a novel about, what else, baseball. I spoke to Boughton in 1986, and he told me a story that might help explain why Mickey Mantle doesn't like to talk about Boughton's book.
I think the most controversial story in the book was I told about the time Mickey Mantle hit a home run with a hangover. And it wasn't really even so much as a put-down of Mickey Mantle as it was a story of what a great athlete he was. I told about the time we were in Minnesota, and we'd been out the night before a game having a few drinks, about 2 o'clock in the morning, I guess it was. I don't want to say Mickey was drunk, but he spent about a half an hour trying to make a telephone call from a grandfather's clock. So he comes into the ballpark the following morning, and he's hungover, and the manager says, you know, sleep it off. Most managers were players themselves. They understand you come to the ballpark once in a while with a hangover. So Mick is sleeping in the trainer's room. We're playing the Minnesota Twins. We got to stick somebody else in the outfield. And so the game's going on, and gets tie score after 9 innings. And in about the 12th inning, the manager says, I hate to do it, but I'm going to need a pinch hitter in the 13th. Go in and wake up the Mick. So we go in the trainer's room, you know, wake up Mickey Mantle, dress him in his uniform, steer him through the tunnel up into the dugout. 13th inning comes around. He put a bat in Mickey's hands and point him in the direction of home plate. The Mick staggers up to the plate. Fortunately, he's a switch hitter. Doesn't matter what side he gets on. Steps into the batter's box. They show you what a great athlete this guy was. And Mickey was the best ball player I ever saw. He takes one practice swing, and it's the first pitch into the center field bleachers. A tremendous blast 450 feet away. We win the game. The crowd is going nuts, and the players are going crazy in the dugout. We're laughing and pointing and screaming and slapping each other on the back, and suddenly it occurs to us, he still has to round those bases. There's a rule in baseball that you must touch the bases in order. Fortunately, he heads off in the right direction. The minute he hits first base, the entire dugout goes, make a left. Goes around, touches second, touches third, comes across, misses home plate. We have to send him back for that. Comes over to the dugout, and of course, the fans are giving him a standing ovation. And as he's waving to the crowd, he looks at us in the dugout and he says, those people don't know how tough that really was. I went over to his locker afterwards and I said, how did you do that? You couldn't even see up there. He said, it was very simple. I hit the middle ball. So if this destroys America's illusions about baseball or Mickey Mantle, then I don't know what you do with all the literature that's come out since then, where each player tries to top the next in terms of what he can tell or how far he can go.
Well, did you have illusions when you were growing up of baseball players being perfect human beings?
Sure, I thought they were.
And very pure.
I thought they were all American kids. I really did. I thought you didn't drink, you didn't smoke, and you didn't stay out late at night, and that's how you got to the big leagues. And that's pretty much how I lived my life when I was a kid. And I finally got to the big leagues. My first night with the New York Yankees, we were on a road trip in Washington, D.C. I'll never forget this. We're staying at the Shoreham Hotel. And at 3 o'clock in the morning, there's a knock on my door, and it's Whitey Ford, Mickey Mantle, Cleet Boyer, Ralph Terry. Half the team are there. They want to take me up on the roof of the Shoreham Hotel to get drunk and look in windows. And I realized I wasn't in shape to be a major league ball player.
This is look in windows to see women undress.
Whatever. But it was crazy. I mean, I thought, geez, is this what it's like to be in the big leagues? But, I mean, I wasn't turned off by it. I wasn't disgusted by it. I just said, this is crazy. This is wacky. This is funny. I still enjoyed playing baseball in the big leagues. I mean, I still thought Mickey Mantle was a great ball player. I stopped seeing ball players and athletes as super people. But I think that's a healthy thing, and I don't think anybody should look up to athletes as special people. They're not special people. They're ordinary people with special skills, and that's it.
We're listening to a 1986 interview with Jim Boughton. He'll talk about his pitching career in a minute. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hot enough for you, Noah?
Yeah, it's pretty bad here in the nation's capital and elsewhere as well. We'll be doing some hot weather conversations. We'll talk with some folks who are working out in the weather. A carpenter up on a roof, a woman taking money at a toll booth on the Massachusetts Turnpike, a bicycle messenger riding down the street. Also, John Itzi from Tokyo on the wrap-up of the G7 conference. Marjorie Sun with the story of how the Japanese have received Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton is very popular in Japan. And a report from London on the story of the Romanov bones. Scientists there have been examining the remains of Russia's last Tsar.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Former pitcher and writer Jim Boughton is my guest. If you could start in baseball again, would you want to go back as a pitcher?
I think so. I enjoyed, you know, initiating the action. I enjoyed the thinking and the strategy involved in figuring out what pitch to throw. I could never stand around in the outfield waiting for something to happen. That wasn't me. I had to be the quarterback. I had to be the pitcher. I had to be involved in the activity. Maybe I could have been a catcher, but pitching is much more suited to my personality.
Pitching careers are subject to more problems than other careers are, I think, because your arm is so vulnerable and your career depends on your arm, and it's what you're abusing all the time.
Sure, and pitching is not a natural motion. Throwing a ball as hard as you can 120 times every 4 days is not natural, and it's going to take its toll on your arm, and a lot of people get sore arms and get burned out in high school, and they never ever get anywhere. Some guys do it and burn out in college. Some guys burn out in the minor leagues. Some guys burn out after 2 or 3 years in the big leagues, like I did. Others just can throw forever, seemingly, but it's hard to tell. You'd almost have to have to cut their arms open and figure out why some arms are able to tolerate it more than others.
To play well, you're damaging your most valuable asset, which is your arm. How would you evaluate pain to decide whether this pain was the kind of pain you just play with or whether this was the kind of pain that meant permanent damage and that would really hurt you in the months and years to come?
A great question, because that was always the hardest thing to do as an athlete. Does this thing that's hurting me now, should I stop because it's going to ruin my career, or am I babying myself, and if I don't push past this pain, I'm never going to get better? So you never knew, you know, you never knew. You would just have to take that chance and push past it, because you have sore arms all your life. I had a sore arm, you know, through my entire childhood, but it would get better and it would get sore and it would get better. It's like climbing trees when you're a kid. Once in a while, you're going to fall out of the tree. You just hope you don't get hurt too badly and climb back up there again. Either, if you wanted to will a perfect arm to science, you shouldn't be a baseball player.
You say that most pitchers are paranoid about their arm. What would you worry about or try not to do?
Well, you try not to sleep on it funny. You try not to, you never reach into your toilet articles bag for your razor with your right hand. When you're on the road trip, you always reach in with your left hand so you don't grab a razor blade. If you trip and fall, you immediately turn your body to the left. I have never gotten an injection in my right arm. I was always afraid of getting an infection, an infected needle, creating some sort of a problem. So you're always looking to protect your arm.
Did you have to change your pitching style because of injuries you were getting?
Well, I had to change my pitching style when I wasn't able to throw hard anymore. See, what happened was I threw very hard when I first came up. I was a overhand fastball pitcher. And then when I hurt my arm, I wasn't able to throw hard for a while, and then when I did it, the ball didn't have that zip on it anymore. It didn't have that snap, even though the ball was traveling as fast, it wasn't moving. So it's like taking a rubber band and stretching it too far, and then it never gets its elasticity back again, and that's what happened to my arm. So I had to change from being a fastball pitcher to a knuckleball pitcher. Fortunately, when I was a kid, I threw a knuckleball, which is not a pitch that requires very much strength. It's a skill pitch. You push it off with your fingertips. The idea is to get the ball to go through the air without any rotation, and then it jumps around all by itself. And so I became a knuckleball pitcher to compensate for the fact that I couldn't throw hard anymore.
How hard are knuckleballs to hit?
They're almost impossible to hit when you throw a good one. The difficulty is throwing a good one. When you don't throw a good one, anybody can hit them. That's the problem with a knuckleball. Nobody can hit a well-thrown knuckleball, and almost anybody can hit a poorly thrown knuckleball.
Say it was a full count and there were a couple of men on base. What would you throw? Would you throw a knuckleball knowing that if you made one wrong move, it might be a home run because it's easier to hit?
I would throw a knuckleball. I would throw a knuckleball because my feeling is I would rather live and die with my best pitch than take a chance with something that wasn't my best.
Did you have any gestures that you had to do before you threw a pitch, you know, like rub your hand on your side three times or?
Nothing, nothing that was superstitious. I'm sure I went through the same sort of little rituals before I threw the ball because it's important to do that, and athletes need to do that, and many performers need to do that because those are the little steps that are really part of the process. Throwing a ball is not just throwing a ball. Part of it starts when you walk out to the mound, how you walk out to the mound, how you feel about yourself, how you feel when you're standing on the mound, what you think of the relationship between home plate and the mound and the fans and the batter and the whole, I mean, all of that, the rosin bag in your hand, how that ball feels. And you want to start playing with that ball in your hand so you get that feeling. And you want to recreate the memory, the muscle memory that brings you back to the last time you were really throwing well. And that whole process starts long before you actually throw the ball.
Why do pitchers like to chew when they're on the mound?
Part of it is because of the nervousness and the tension, and it sort of chewing relieves that. But the spitting part is different, okay? Spitting and also all this crotch grabbing and spitting back and forth that you see in Major League Baseball, there's a real reason for that. There's a behavioral reason for that, and that is that what these are is macho displays. Okay, it's a man-to-man challenge out there, the pitcher versus the batter, and it's very much like two cats squaring off, where they both have to sort of urinate on the shrubbery, saying, "Okay, this is my yard, I own this space," and the other cat saying, "Yeah, but I own my space," and then they're fighting. You see, what the batter is he's steps into the batter's box and he spits all over the place. He's saying that's his turf. The pitcher's saying, "Oh yeah, well, this is my turf out here, and now we'll see who's the best." And so that's why you have this. It's a marking of territory, and it's a macho display. It's like, it's that mano a mano challenge situation, you know, and that's what they are. They're animals marking their territory.
Jim Boughton, I want to thank you very much.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Former Yankees pitcher Jim Boughton, recorded in 1986. More interviews from the Fresh Air Archives next week at this time. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Richard Parker, Chris Fraley, and Ron Barron. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our program was directed today by Naomi Person. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a crime writer who spent about half of his life behind bars. We'll talk with Edward Bunker. There's a new edition of his 1973 novel, No Beast So Fierce. It was the basis of the film Straight Time, which starred Dustin Hoffman. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.